Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Deborah Blum, whose latest book is The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. Deborah Blum is 1992 winner of the Pulitzer Prize, reporting for the Sacramento Bee, author of Ghost Hunters, Love at Goon Park, Sex on the Brain, and The Monkey Wars. This latest book, The Poisoner's Handbook, ostensibly is about poisons and how we came to learn about them, but in fact it's really kind of an alternate history of the 1920s with a focus on, oddly enough, politics, prohibition, and also the birth of forensic medicine as we know it today. So let me start by asking, your last book was Ghost Hunters and dealt with possibilities of life after death and the search for life after death in the late 19th century. This book is about the 1920s and forensics. What brought you to this topic?
Well, I'm fascinated by moments in history that seem to me to shift the way the world works. And I also like them because you can really say to yourself, well, here's a moment that changed the world. When you go back far enough, you can actually figure that out. When it's just happened yesterday, you're kind of like, could change the world, maybe it wouldn't. So in both Ghost Hunters and in the Poisoner's Handbook, I was really interested in illuminating a moment in history. And I think of it as the invention of forensic toxicology, the invention of the kind of CSI kind of scientist. What was the world like before that happened? How dangerous was it? And I was interested in exploring that and finding out if it was easy to kind of push that change along.
What exactly started that idea? I mean, was it watching an episode of CSI?
I mean, I love those forensic crime scene things, and my favorite actually is Bones, which everyone tells me is the most inaccurate of all of them. But no, I'd say Agatha Christie. I grew up with my mother's collection of early 20th century mysteries. I always loved them and always liked those elegant poison murders. And so after a while, I was kicking around the idea of doing something that would really make people think about how poison works, which is a kind of a fundamental part of this book. What are these things and how do they actually kill us? But I wanted that to include a story. And once I found these two kind of revolutionary scientists in the 1920s, I thought, okay, here I am. Let's go.
Well, these two scientists are Charles Norris and Alexander Gettler. How did you discover them? What happened to put you on their trail?
It took me 6 desperate months after I had signed the contract on this book of saying, how am I going to tell this poison story? And eventually I started seeing in these obscure footnotes references to Gettler as the father of American forensic toxicology. So my first thought was, well, where's the book? And there was nothing. And so I ended up tunneling, essentially. I was like a little mole going underground trying to find these guys. And I discovered the papers of Charles Norris in the archives in New York, and I went there. They had been buried so deep, so long in the New York City archives that both my grad researcher and I were sick when we left. We'd inhaled too much hideous subterranean dust, I think. But it was a great experience.
This guy Norris, he was the medical examiner. Do you recall exactly how you found out that those papers existed and also what was in the papers? Because I noticed that in the book you frequently tell the story from Norris's perspective.
I do, and that's because far more than Gettler, Norris's voice and documents and letters and exchanges are in those papers. So he became a really strong personality in my book, and he was a strong personality. He was an extremely wealthy upper register East Coast descendant of Revolutionary War heroes who spent his fortune building a forensics medicine laboratory, essentially, signed up for it, poured his own money into it, and was passionately devoted to it, and was incredibly a huge, flamboyant guy who liked to fight with people. I mean, he was really an interesting guy. So you can imagine his personality coming out strongly anyway. I found those papers. I kept thinking to myself, didn't these guys leave a trace anywhere? I mean, literally, there was nothing except for newspaper accounts and the scientific papers. And so I started calling libraries and archives in New York. And the thing about this New York archive, I mean, this is a classic New York story. I finally hunted down a very reluctant archivist who told me they had Norris's papers from 1918 to 1935, which was when he died. And so I said, great, I'm coming out. I'm going to look at them. And I go into the archive building and walk up to the counter and say, I'm here to look at the Norris papers. And the guy goes, we don't have those. I said, yeah, you do. He goes, no, we don't have anything like that. So I'm like, yes, you do. And so finally I said, and I talked to so-and-so, and here's his phone number. You have to call him. I never met this archivist. He would not come up to meet me, but from somewhere down underneath the floor, he verified that these papers were, and they came creaking up on this old dumbwaiter. It was like being in a horror movie, right? And the elevator comes up, and there's these gray, dusty boxes. And for me, it was, wow. I mean, aside from not wanting to have a respiratory infection, the whole wow of finding something that you realize that people really hadn't looked at. That you could discover someone, this amazing person who'd been forgotten. That's a wonderful feeling.
These are letters, documents of all kinds?
There's letters. There's, just the basic behind-the-scene reports of the medical examiner's office. He actually had in there some of his biographical material. There's letters from him. There's letters to him. I mean, you can actually trace these letters in which, you know, you can see him working to manipulate the mayors. He was always fighting with the mayors. You can see the mayors having meltdowns. It was amazing treasure trove of information. It wasn't the science so much, but one of the things I wanted to do in the book is I wanted it to read like a 1920s mystery. I wanted it to have that Agatha Christie, it's aiming high, but that Agatha Christie feel. And so I really wanted to set it in the period. So a lot of what I got out of those documents was just the way things worked. You know, the corruption in city government was there, the ridiculous list of the broken furniture that the mayor was what the mayor let him have for his office. I mean, it was fascinating for me. And, you know, and I'm always looking for details that I think tell a story. So it was full of those.
Including the fact that when the mayor said you can have cars for the medical examiners, he gave them cars.
He did. In fact, he paid for his own chauffeur. I mean, he was the guy who expected to be driven by a chauffeur. But the other thing was, you know, this is the 1920s. Automobiles are just starting to boom. Nobody knows how to drive. And he was afraid his medical examiners would kill themselves, literally. So they had to have drivers. And there was one point where one of the mayors cut his car allowance and he quit. He just said, that's it. You know, if you're not even going to give me a car, I'm out of here. And they had to beg him to come back, and they did. And he did. He would have been bored if he hadn't been out there.
It's an amazing story. You break it down into chapters that deal with different poisons and how Gettler determined what the poisons were, and then the political background of how Norris was dealing with the people in the city. And it takes us from the birth of Prohibition pretty much to the end of Prohibition, which means it's also a story of Prohibition. And a lot of things I didn't know. I didn't realize that so much of the country was against Prohibition, and that they also knew that it would be not merely a social disaster, but a medical disaster as well.
Yeah, I hadn't either. Prohibition is sort of background music of this whole story. And a lot of the poisons I write about are directly related to Prohibition, because bootleg whiskey was so often poisonous. And because the U.S. government, and I spent some time talking about this, in its frustration over the failures of Prohibition, realized that people were drinking stolen industrial alcohol and launched a campaign to scare them off by making it super poisonous and killed thousands of people, just thousands. And when I read that, the first time I saw it, I thought, that can't be right. I don't remember that. I don't remember the government was out killing people during Prohibition. So I went back and I went through, you know, the Washington Post and the LA Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, and it's everywhere. I don't know how we forgot it. But yes, Prohibition sets the sort of background of the book, and it's one of the things I like about the feel of the book. It's always struck me that our response to Prohibition was as close to anarchy as this country ever came, because you have a constitutional amendment and you have a massive set of laws under the Volstead Act to enforce it, and the people don't do it. There's 30,000 speakeasies in New York City alone. There's 60 million gallons of industrial alcohol stolen every year. There's alcoholism rates going up 300 to 600% according to the insurance company record. So this complete refusal to abide by the law and the whole wild lawlessness of that period in some ways that I wanted to get at, from what businesses could get away with, from what poisoners could get away with, are all embedded in that basic defiant, you know, behavior of society as a whole.
Deborah Blum, it was fascinating reading that, because we kind of think we live in a vacuum, yet of course, you know, our antecedents are right there. And I'm sure as you were reading this documentation and writing about it, you were thinking of comparisons with today and how we view things today. Can you be a little specific in what kind of things you saw when you were thinking in those terms?
The Prohibition poisoning, when I mentioned it to people, everyone compared it to the government's 1970s program to spray paraquat, the herbicide, on marijuana crops in Mexico. And if you look at the government response to paraquat spraying, where people will say, well, what if people smoke this and they die? The rationale's the same. Well, if they're going to break the law and do this, you know, destructive, illegal thing, too bad for them, right? So there's that. But I think there's other things. It's been interesting to me since I did the book. I started a blog that I called A Blog About Culture and Chemistry, and it's actually called Speakeasy Science because I wanted it to have some of that history feel. And in it, I find myself quite often drawing parallels with some of the poison problems of the 1920s. You know, we're still really careless with chemicals. We still have homicidal poisonings. In fact, they've gone up slightly since the turn of the 21st century. To give you a really good example, I spend some time in the book, I was fascinated by the poison carbon monoxide, which inhabits our lives. And I looked at it as a homicidal tool. It was a fantastic homicidal tool. I looked at it as a pollutant. I was amazed to find out how much they knew about the poisons in cigarette smoke in the 1920s. So I looked at it in that context. And today, if I go, there was a medical journal report just last year that we still have 50,000 accidental carbon monoxide poisonings every year in this country. I mean, mostly not fatal. There were a raft of carbon monoxide deaths after those big East Coast snowstorms. So we still have these same chemicals, and we still really don't understand them and don't treat them with the respect they deserve. I mean, chemistry is a beautiful thing. I really tried to make people appreciate how gorgeous I think chemistry is in the book. All those beautiful thing, colors bubbling away. But it's sinister. Chemistry is beautiful and sinister, and we forget how sinister it is.
There's a quote from your blog: "We've built a society that depends on industrial chemistry, and we still don't always fully consider the implications of that." And this is now, we're talking 80 years, 90 years, maybe even 100 years since chemistry began to infiltrate our society.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? Sometimes I think, and it's one of the reasons I do like history, is that you get to, in a kind of subversive way, say, smack, we already know this, get a grip, let's do it right now, right? And it's so frustrating. And I kind of think that it adds some merit to the arguments we have today, where you can't just say, oops, sorry, just discovered that, right? You want to hold people to account and say, you know what, individual health matters. Our environment matters, and poison is about both. Obviously, we don't want murderers, right? So let's get a grip on some of these things. You know, let's remember that forensic science is about environmental health and public health, too, and let's use it in a smart way.
You're listening to an interview with Deborah Blum, whose latest book is The Poisoner's handbook. As I was reading about the wide open society of the 20s and the lack of regulations, I noticed that you talk about a book called 100 Million Guinea Pigs, which went through its ninth printing by 1935. The FDA was a joke.
We didn't even begin to think about regulating food and drugs until right after the turn of the 20th century. And Teddy Roosevelt forced through the Food and Drug Act. American business was horrified by this. They'd always been able to put anything they wanted to into anything. I mean, literally, and the law was so timid that literally it did not even require people to label ingredients on cosmetics or household products. So, and I used one example of this in my book. You had mascara for women that had actually corrosive compounds in it. People had cornea damage, but there was nothing that said. There was lead in hair coloring. There was radioactive material in face creams. Unbelievable. And you look at it, you think, couldn't we just step up here a little and try to fix this? There are people today who believe that somehow we're going to have this wonderful, healthy, careful society without regulation. But this is a fantastic example of what you look like when you don't have regulation, one, and when you're passing, when a government, the other thing about prohibition, when you have a government on a moral crusade, which prohibition was, that government does things like poison its own citizens because it thinks the ends justify the means. Two, when you're so determined to be laissez-faire about regulation of businesses, you get a plethora of these dangerous chemicals, and guess what? They kill people. You know, one of the examples I used was lead in gasoline. And we knew in the 1920s that lead was a terrible thing to put in gasoline. It had killed workers in a horrible way, and the government and the big industries conspired to make sure that that just went away. And it's really phenomenal.
It's interesting. I just finished reading the next book for my interview, which is Country Driving by Peter Hessler, talking about China and the factories that are making phony leather in China, which are poisoning people there today because they don't have regulations.
Exactly. And you can look at, Disney had to recall some of its children's jewelry because of the cadmium poisoning from China. There was a push on Target to recall teddy bears of Valentine's Day, you remember? Lead in those toys. And China represents what we were before regulation to me to some extent. Do I think we do it perfectly? No, but they're a good example of what happens when you just say, well, you know, this is the cheapest, best way to do it. And if I look the other way because it's not a little safe, that's okay because it would interfere with production. And they did a lot of that in the 20s. I mean, a lot. And it was much worse than it is today. And lots more people died.
That means that the work of people like Norris and Gettler, even though they were mostly dealing with murders, what we saw was the beginning of transparency.
And that was one of the things that I found so fascinating about them, is that when they took on a poison, be it cyanide or arsenic or carbon monoxide, they really took it on. And they didn't say, well, I'm only focused on murders, although, you know, they really worked hard on murders, and there's a lot of them in my book. But with cyanide, for instance, they look at murders, but at the time you could actually do home fumigation for pests with hydrogen cyanide, and people were dying. I mean, you go, why would anyone use hydrogen cyanide to fumigate a home? And Norris actually had to lobby to get the city of New York to prevent that. They really saw poisons as something that were, as I said in my blog, they're woven through society and they had to be looked at in every way that they pose a danger. So, I love the murderous, creepy crime stories in the way that everyone likes a good murder story. But I really like reminding people that this is part of our world. We've built a culture based on chemistry. Let's have some respect for it.
Well, it seems to me, Deborah Blum, that when you're writing, even though you're trying to be a dispassionate journalist, what happens is a political point of view has to sneak in, not only with that, but also when you're talking about global climate change,
right,
when you're talking about all of these issues, and when you're talking about the opposition, either in terms of no regulation or in terms of religion.
I always write essentially from a point of view, and I think all good writers do that, right? And we had this idea that somehow journalism, and I come from a journalistic background, did most justice to a story by being completely neutral. He said, she said, reader, you go figure out what's going on. I don't believe that. I think that you tell a story, you spend 2 years doing research, and then you say, here's what really matters in the story, and I want people to hear that. I want them to hear that I admire these underpaid civil servant bench scientists who almost never get any credit, who changed toxicology and made the world safer. I want them to hear that I think chemicals are worth regulating, and that industry is worth regulating, and that we can look at this very timid approach to public health and say, this did not work. You know, hundreds and hundreds of people died because we were afraid to take these on. And I want to remind people, we should take them on.
Now, you teach journalism. We've got an entire field of he said, she said, where the sky is blue versus the sky is polka dot get equal time.
I agree. And I think that's one of the reasons that people kind of roll their eyes sometimes over journalistic coverage. Yeah, it's tricky because is one version of the truth the right version? You know, truth's complicated, and there's always many angles and facets to a story. So you do want to get all those different angles and facets. And when I teach that, I say to my students, look, do your homework. Feel like you've really got nailed all the questions here, and then you tell me what the story is about. What's the story about? And everything falls around that. And to me, that is fair. But to do the he said, she said thing, when one person may have spent, 30 years selflessly studying it and another person, spilled coffee on their foot and is in a bad mood that day and had never studied it anyway, that doesn't do anyone a service. I think readers have a right to expect that the journalist who has spent some time studying the issue tries to give some shape to what's going on.
Do you think there's a difference between science journalism and political journalism?
I'll tell you the one difference right off the top of my head. If I have a very complicated science story with a lot of technical things, I'll ask a scientist to read it for me, because I don't want to be famous for the science writer who got it wrong. No science journalist can be an expert in every field. It's not like I'm going to take my story on something that happened at the White House and ask Robert Gibbs or Barack Obama to check it out for me for accuracy. So science writers can get in there at that level in a way political reporters can't. And that just shows that you're approaching kind of different information systems, I think. One of the things that I think is true in political reporting and in science reporting is that, we've got stories to tell, and science and politics are both about human beings making decisions. And human beings making decisions that are influenced by all kinds of emotions, right? From greed to anger to moral superiority or whatever is influencing you, that goes into science as much as it goes into politics. And one of the things I have thought we have done badly in science writing, and why I like to build my stories around people, is that I think the rest of us need to remember it's just, your neighbor. These guys are just like the guy next door going out and doing their job and trying to solve a problem or make a difference. And I don't see scientists on some exalted plane, and I don't see politicians on that plane either, obviously.
Well, I remember having a conversation with Stephen Jay Gould several years ago. We were discussing the theory of evolution, and he said, the fundamentalists talk about the theory as if it's a theory and could just as easily be wrong, but that's not what a scientific theory is.
That's right. And I think a lot of people don't understand some of these basic principles of science. A theory is actually a hypothesis that has been tested to the point that it has some stability, and then you just keep adding evidence to it. A theory is not today's guess. It's true that people will treat, especially theories that they don't like. Now, you never hear anyone say, the theory of gravity is just a theory. It's only the theories that people for political or religious reasons don't like. Then they're just a theory. Whereas, gravity is a theory. It doesn't even make any sense the way we approach it.
Deborah Blum, you've gone quite a ways from your previous book, Ghost Hunters. Okay. And on Ghost Hunters, I'm just going to ask one question. Is there life after death?
Oh, totally. Well, I think everyone would love to have the answer to that question, and I certainly would. People used to ask me all the time when I did that book, they'd say, do you believe in ghosts? And I'd say, I think the interesting question is, why do we see ghosts, right? Why do we see ghosts? Why do we need to have a life after death? And so what's interesting to me about the ghost supernatural stuff is it talks about us, you know, our connection with possibilities, our need for more. I wish I could tell you I'd found the shining answer, but so far that one's still eluding me.
Well, okay, let's get back to Poisoner's Handbook. And obviously, you know, this was a treasure trove of material that you didn't expect. You were constantly being hit by revelations. What revelation do you think made the most impact that you haven't already mentioned?
That's a good question. One of the things that intrigued me when I started the book is that I had thought of Poisoner's, I think, in a kind of glamour sense, you know, the coldest poisoners, the ones who planned and calculated and schemed and somehow were more brilliant. When you get really up close to murderous people, they're not glamorous at all. They're just yucky, creepy, awful people. So, and that was actually, I mean, it sounds so funny, but that was a revelation to me, you know, that it was just like, nah, you're not so special. And, you know, my book doesn't glamorize poisoners. So I'll tell you the one thing my book has changed is that all of my friends and in every situation, people treat me differently than they did before I became a poison expert, you know? I'm destined for a life of jokes about, oh, I'll just put my hand over my coffee cup while you're in the room, right? And that's okay. But so far, they're still alive.
It seems, looking at your blob, that you become very obsessed with poisons. I mean, writing about aconite and wolf's bane, which isn't even in your book.
I know, I am obsessed with poisons. And that was, you know, and I had all these wonderful stories that I couldn't fit in my book, and all these questions about poisons. And you can probably tell when you read the book, I do find them just fascinating. The way they work, the way people try to use them. The aconite poisoning you were talking about was a woman in London who poisoned her ex-lover by stirring very evil plant seeds into his leftover curry, and he died, and she went to jail. And the whole plottingness of that, having said I think, you know, people are yucky and creepy, it's still fascinating. And the way we interact with poisons all the time and the way that they're part of our lives. I mean, one of the things I realized with the blog, I'll never run out of material. I do a Google alert on poison. It's unbelievable. And now all my friends are sending me poison stuff. I'll spend the rest of my life fascinated by poisons.
You've also learned a little, I think, about the nature of government and prohibition. From a political sense, what direction should we be thinking in terms of both not only prohibition and government, but also regulation?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, you mentioned earlier that my book is kind of a political history, and it is. You know, I'm looking at a very specific political cultural moment through the lens of poison, but I'm interested in what society was like at that time. And what it tells me, again, is, I'm going to sound a little bit redundant, we've built a culture that depends on a lot of very dangerous things. Our systems work, our lives work, our high technology culture works because it is supported by lethal chemicals. I mean, we see this in our waste dumps. We see this in the kind of pollution we have. Almost everything we make in some ways will have some kind of toxic material. And that period of the 1920s was when we really started putting that system into place. And so I think that it made me think more seriously about how the fact that government needed to be, all of us, but especially government, take the role of protector here. I mean, we need some wisdom about, you know, it would, of course, I sound naive when I say that, but be nice to see some thoughtful guidance and meaningful regulation from government that would give us some kind of shelter when we need it from this toxic world that we've built.
Each day we have a new drug that's being pulled off the market because of diseases. This one about heart attacks coming from
the diabetes yeah. drug. Yes, and because, and you can say, well, if that drug had been thoroughly and carefully studied instead of rushed through, maybe we wouldn't have had these deaths. And so going back to the same thing, chemistry is beautiful and chemistry is sinister, right? You can take carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, and one way it is sugar and another way it is strychnine. And you don't want to mess around with it. You know, I mean, if I could, I'd really like to smack someone. And not really, but, you know, and just say, come on, this is so obvious. Let's take something that we've known since the 1920s and let's do something smart about it.
Deborah Blum, you've finished the Poisoner's Handbook. Obviously, you're still obsessed with poisons. But have you begun thinking in terms of the next area that you plan to cover?
Well, I've actually thought about staying in this period and looking at food safety. It's really a fascinating time for that as well, because people didn't actually know anything about what was in food at the time. So the whole approach to food and what we put in it was totally bizarre. I'm either going to do that, or I'm going to find myself so addicted to the criminal mind that I'll do something else a little forensic-like. I've actually thought about doing that, and that would be a new one for me. And I like the intersection of science and society, so all my books kind of, you know, balance on that point. But I've changed my perspective with each one, primates or love or ghosts or poison, for me to be really obsessed. If I did another poison book, you know I had a problem.
If you were going to kill someone, which poison would you use? And secondly, who are your favorite science writers?
I don't know if I want to tell that one. If I was going to kill someone, and I'm not going to name the poison, but from doing research, there's a couple of poisons that I know that I could get my hands on that don't leave much of a trace and look pretty much like a natural death in the results, that I could actually probably put together from common household ingredients. I actually, when I was doing the research on my book, at one point I called my editor. I was so freaked out. I go, oh, I know how to make this lethal thing in the basement. And she said, don't put that in the book. I'm like, I'm not going to. I'm never going to tell. I mean, I really was going to like, So, but, you know, if I did it, I'd want to get away with it. That's kind of creepy, but I would. So that's my roundabout answer to that. My favorite science writers, I think that Carl Zimmer, who does a lot of gorgeous biology, is amazing. He has a blog called The Loom that is just beautiful. I think Stephen Johnson, who wrote The Invention of Air, is a beautiful writer. I mean, you know, you just kind of read his stuff and go, oh, I wish I'd written that. I did a blurb for Rebecca Skloot's book. I mean, she worked on that book a long time, so that's her book. That would be The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's a terrific book. It really is. Mary Roach's books, Bonk and, you know, Stiff, and I think she's working on one on, you know, How We Prepare for Life in Outer Space now. And because I love subversive approaches to science, you know, and she's brilliant at it. She, you know, she doesn't make all science all stiff and strange and scary. She takes you right in there and lets you have a blast with it. So I actually think she's pretty brilliant.
I can see a movie coming out of a book like The Poisoner's Handbook. Has anybody approached you?
Yes, I've been approached by some producers. I'm a William Morris client, so they are actually talking to movie producers. Also, some television producers, there's been some real interest in saying this could make a really cool period piece, forensics, Prohibition, Jazz Age kind of forensics where they're chasing poisoners and murderers all the time. So they're pretty optimistic. I'm available to consult on any script.
One final question concerning the future of journalism, because you worked for several years in the Fresno and Sacramento Bee and you're teaching journalism. Do you see a model, any model on the horizon to save newspapers?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, I say to people a lot, I don't teach my past. I don't think we'll save the newspaper model that I knew when I was a reporter for the Sacramento Bee or Fresno Bee. I think we've lost that. I think it's too late to bring that back. I know the New York Times is, you know, going to start experimenting with a paywall. The Wall Street Journal has a paywall that it uses pretty successfully. Somewhere in all this fumbling and bumbling around that we're doing, I think we'll come up with a good newspaper venture. Yeah, that's partly online, partly print, partly something we haven't figured out yet. I mean, I do believe that, and I think it's really important. I actually believe we need gatekeepers. And I believe that an independent press is, as obviously Thomas Jefferson said it better, but part of democracy. It doesn't exist without it. So there's things that we really have to work to save. Yeah, I'm teaching the next generation. It doesn't do them or me any good for me to, you know, drool over what used to be. And so, I'm doing my best to try to think about ways to make the next generation smarter. And that's what I really think we have to do. The old model wasn't perfect. Certainly we did a lousy job, say, with the, now I sound political, with reporting the Iraq War. We could do better. So maybe in all of this crisis, we'll figure out a way to actually have a smarter model.
You've been listening to an interview with Deborah Blum, whose latest book is The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age, New York. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.